Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation have a history of illegal break-ins to homes and offices without a search warrant. In the years when J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI, these warrantless break-ins came to be known as black bag jobs. This archive edition of Radio Curious is a December 1995 interview with Wesley Swearingen, a former FBI agent who, in 1995, wrote a book called FBI Secrets, An Agent's Exposé. His book describes some of the black bag warrantless searches in which he was involved and his opinion of those activities. He ends his book by saying that the Hoover era will continue to haunt the FBI because J. Edgar Hoover knowingly undermined the United States Constitution. When I spoke with Wesley Swearingen from his home in Tucson, Arizona, I asked him what he meant by that.
Well, the FBI flaunted the Constitution by doing what we called black bag jobs. They were illegal entries into the homes and offices of individuals that Hoover and his associates felt were enemies of this country, starting off with the Communist Party, and then later on it became religious groups such as the Nation of Islam in Chicago, and then other groups that opposed the Vietnam War, and then groups like the Black Panther Party and the Weatherman Underground Organization, a radical offshoot of the Students for a Democratic Society. And in the Security Division, we just flaunted the Constitution. I mean, it didn't mean anything to us.
Well, how were the targets of the black bag jobs identified?
Well, first of all, I guess I can better describe it if I talk about the Communist Party in Chicago, because I'm more familiar with that. We would identify the top leaders and then target them for bag jobs. And if we found information that was worth going after later on, in another month or two, then we would repeat that. If there was nothing in a person's home or office, then we would go after other individuals. And if we suspected someone as a courier later on, when there were people who became fugitives because they had been indicted for a violation of the Smith Act and then disappeared, we would try to get information through black bag jobs of the location of these fugitives through the couriers. And you know, maybe they would have letters that they were taking to other people who might know something about the location of a particular fugitive.
Well, in your book, you indicate that you were an FBI agent who did these black bag jobs. So that means that you actually went into people's homes and businesses?
Yes, I did.
And when you did that, did you leave it in such a way that people had known that you were there?
No. All the ones that I did, we measured first, and just about that time, Polaroid developed the instant camera, which was great assistance, because if we wanted to look at someone's papers on a desk, for instance, we could take a photograph, and in about 60 seconds we'd have a photograph of exactly how things were placed on the desk. And before that, the development of the Polaroid, we would have to take notes, copious notes, and we would use a ruler to measure maybe an envelope so far from the front of the desk and so far from the side of the desk, and try to remember exactly how to place it. And then after we made those notes, we would open up the letter, and if there's something in there worth photographing, we would photograph it, put it back exactly the way we found it. So
how did you open the letter so that it could be sealed without it being revealed that it had been opened?
Well, if they were actually sealed, then we would try to steam it open. And it's not too difficult if you have the time. If, say, we went in at 9 o'clock in the morning after someone had gone to work on an eight-hour job, and he was there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then if everything else was all right, that meant that we could stay there probably till 4 o'clock in the afternoon before he'd get home. But we always had those other agents following them to work to make sure that that's where they were. So if we had the time, then we'd start a little teapot on the stove, use the person's stove to generate a little steam, and open it up and read it, photograph it if it was important, and then reseal it.
How pervasive was this? You're talking about it now in the early 50s, during the height of the communist McCarthy scare.
Well, I consider it very pervasive. In Chicago at the time, we had about 275 agents. There were about 25 of us, close to 10% of the office, doing nothing but bag jobs on the Communist Party. And we did this. This was our only job for several years.
Going into people's homes and looking at their personal papers.
And yes, and going into their offices. You know, when they'd go home at night, then we'd go into their offices.
How would you get in to either the home or the office?
Well, the safest way was to try to get a key. And if we were going into someone's home, normally all these people lived in apartment buildings in Chicago, so it wasn't too difficult to make arrangements with the janitor or the superintendent of the building just to give us a key. Of course, we would always have to check his background first and make sure that he was on our side.
So in other words, the janitor or the superintendent knew that this bag job was going on or about to go on at some point?
Well, they had a pretty good idea that this was what we were going to do. And in some instances, we did let them know that we were actually on the premises, just so that, and in one particular case, it proved to be very worthwhile because a neighbor accidentally saw me and another agent go into a person's apartment, and she called the police.
Yeah.
After she called the police, then she called manager of the building, and the manager of the building immediately called the FBI office and told whoever answered the phone in the office that, you know, FBI agents were in an apartment, and one of the neighbors just called the police. And so they passed it on to the radio room, and the gal in the radio room said that a neighbor had called the police. So we packed up our belongings and got out, and just as we hopped into the car, the police were rounding the corner. We were almost caught. That was about the closest situation that I had ever been involved with, and it was close to 500 bag jobs in Chicago.
I understand that after you wrote your book, your boat was raided by the FBI. Was that a bag job, or was it a raid?
That was a raid. That was after I had written my first manuscript, which I titled FBI Chicanery. The reason, I think the reason that the FBI raided it, I had already talked to an attorney who had gone to the Department of Justice and was giving them some of this corruption that I wanted to report to the Attorney General. But the FBI claims that they found some of my material down in Jonestown. This was back in 1978 when Jim Jones gave this Kool-Aid or whatever it was.
Right, the cyanide Kool-Aid to 900 people.
Yeah, and they either committed suicide or were murdered. I don't know that anybody ever figured that one out. But some of my papers were down there, and of course I was completely surprised. I had never heard of Jonestown before or People's Temple, but I discovered that my FBI was giving information to the attorney to give to the attorney general, and they were so paranoid that they had looked at my files when they were in the office, unbeknownst to my attorney.
These are the Jonestown and People's Temple people.
Yeah, the People's Temple. People did a bag job on my attorney's files in San Francisco, and they took some of the information. I had nothing in there about Jonestown. I didn't even know that they existed. I mean, I might have read about them in the newspaper, but it was just something in passing. I had no idea that they were plants.
Well, Wes, you've mentioned the bag jobs that Hoover knowingly did and instructed his people to do. And there's a whole list, a whole shopping list in your book in FBI Secrets, an Agent's Exposé, which is published by South End Press. What are some of the other violations of the Constitution that you can tell us about?
Well, just in general, the kinds of dirty tricks, I don't know that they're necessarily violations of the Constitution, but certainly violations of a person's civil rights to police authorities abusing someone's civil rights, like making them targets of COINTELPRO, that's the code word for counterintelligence program. And certain individuals were chosen to either be fired from their jobs or harassed or break up their divorce, just make life miserable in general. Some instances, they were framed and put in jail. Other times, the FBI arranged assassinations.
Now, tell us about those. You mentioned in your book that the supervisor of the Chicago office was an accessory before the fact of some murders in Chicago.
Yes. The agent who told me about this years after it happened had been one of the agents I worked with in Chicago for many years on these black bag jobs. And we trusted each other with our lives. He felt that I was sympathetic because I had done all these things in the past, and we were having a discussion. We were at Quantico for a training session, and we happened to be sitting there in the little restaurant drinking 3-2 beer, which was the strongest thing that they could have there at Quantico. But we were discussing old times, and we hadn't seen each other for, I guess it was maybe 15 years. And we were talking about the bag jobs back in Chicago, and I said, what we were doing, we thought that was bad. I said, what their agents are doing out in Los Angeles are worse. They're putting innocent people in jail just because they're a leader of the Black Panther Party. He said, well, I got a better one than that. And then he told me about the raid that the Chicago police did on Panther headquarters in 1969, where Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were shot to death. And he said that the FBI had set up the Chicago police to do this raid, hopefully killing maybe a couple of dozen Black Panthers, but that particular night there were only two of them there. And, I couldn't believe it when he said this.
When you talk about this in your book, you make reference to Greg York as being the supervisor in the Chicago office. Is that his real name?
No, that's a fictitious name I used just to protect his privacy and the privacy of his family and children. There would be no point in using his real name. The case was in court. No one was tried or convicted. The only thing that came out of it was a civil suit where the judge says, yes, there was a violation of their civil rights, and the survivors were awarded $1.8 million. So, my mentioning his name was really not important. I'd just be harassing him and opening myself and probably the publisher up to a lawsuit. But, his real name means nothing.
In this archive edition of Radio Curious, recorded in December of 1995, we are visiting with Wesley Swearingen, a former FBI agent and the author of FBI Secrets, an Agent's Exposé, published in 1995. You're listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
Wes, I want to ask you about where you draw the line in your expose and in why you have chosen to write this book about the agency that you say in the preface that you loved so much.
Well, I draw the line at what I consider wrongdoing. Now, I'm not exposing other secrets. I'm not exposing other investigations. I am trying to expose just what I personally know of, where the FBI abused the power of their office, where they violated the Constitution, and just plain outright used unethical tactics against people who have a legal right to express their political beliefs in this country.
What I'm leading to is the history of how the aura or fact of untouchability of the FBI developed, in that they can get away with the bag jobs, that they can get away with being an accessory before the fact to murder, and at the same time are involved in catching bank robbers.
Well, it all started when J. Edgar Hoover took over as director of the FBI back in 1924, and the Attorney General gave him complete authority to do whatever he wanted to straighten out the organization because it was so corrupt when he took over. But it was a different kind of corruption. The agents then were taking kickbacks and just covering over certain investigations. So Hoover took over, and he had this blanket authority. And he started out to do well, and he got so much authority that I guess he figured, hey, you know, this is pretty neat. I've got more power than the President of the United States. And as he got more power and more power, members of Congress were afraid of him. And whenever anyone tried to criticize him, it didn't make any difference whether it was a member of Congress or someone in the media, Hoover would have an investigation conducted on this person's background. And if there was anything at all in the person's background, Hoover would bring it to this person's attention and say, hey, you stop talking about me or we're going to expose all the things that you don't want anyone to know about. And so he was using extortion tactics on members of the media, members of Congress, even presidents of the United States. And so everyone just bowed to him, and when someone has that much authority, there's nothing you can do. I mean, some people tried to expose him, and they were just neutralized, as Hoover would call it.
When you say he was using this power of extortion on presidents, can you give us some specifics?
Well, probably the closest thing was John Kennedy and his brother Bobby, who were Attorney General, who was Attorney General. And when Kennedy started doing certain things and Bobby was telling Hoover this and that, the FBI conducted an investigation on John Kennedy and found that he was having some extramarital affairs prior to becoming president. And he was confronted with this, and so he backed off on some of the things that he was planning to do.
Were there any pre-inauguration, pre-Kennedy inauguration issues that resulted in Kennedy reappointing Hoover as the director of the FBI?
I don't know of any personally, but the thing is, there wasn't any president who really had nerve enough to ask Hoover to retire, even when he was eligible, when he was old enough to retire.
When you say nerve enough, what do you mean?
They were just afraid of their jobs. They were afraid that if they asked Vancouver to step down, that he was going to expose something in their background that they didn't want exposed.
And this flows from what you were saying, where the Attorney General gave Hoover the unprecedented authority to do pretty much what he wanted, and it mushroomed and developed so that he had such an arsenal of knowledge that he could use it against even the presidents?
Well, the Attorney General did, and Congress did, and the president himself did, because everybody was afraid of him.
And now, does that authority extend to the director of the FBI? In the present day?
Well, probably not as much, because we supposedly have congressional guidelines that the FBI has to operate within, and there is supposed to be an oversight by the Attorney General, the Department of Justice. But the thing is, you know, even though these guidelines exist, I don't know how effective it's going to be when all the FBI has to do is lie to the Department of Justice. And certainly there's a perfect case right now under investigation, and that's the Ruby Ridge fiasco where Vicki Weaver shot and killed. I mean, the Senate had hearings, and I think it was five agents who refused to testify. They were taking the Fifth Amendment. I mean, you got agents who have sworn to uphold the Constitution, and they're called before a tribunal, such as the Senate, and they say, "Oh, I can't tell you anything about that. I'm going to claim the Fifth Amendment because I might have done something wrong."
Where does all this lead? It seems like that we have an agency which is part of the executive department of our three parts of government that's just gone radically out of control, that it can do what it wants.
Well, it has been doing what it did what it wanted to do for all the years that I worked for Hoover, within limitations. You know, there's certain things that you just can't blatantly do. It was slightly different than Hitler's Gestapo. I mean, they just didn't care. If they wanted to do something, they'd flat out do it.
They'd walk down the street and shoot someone, whereas here the FBI would destroy them emotionally so that they would kill themselves.
Right. They would have them set up by someone else. You know, the FBI would condone a killing, like the Panthers in Chicago and two of the Panthers in Los Angeles. You know, there were limitations that the FBI could go to, just because if the people knew about it, they just wouldn't have tolerated it. I mean, Hoover would have been out on his ear before the end of the day had Congress and the Attorney General and the President known what was going on.
Well, when you talk about Ruby Ridge and compare it to Hoover being out on his ear, have there been changes in the time since Hoover died and terminated his position as director of FBI? Or maybe his ghost still lingers?
I think his ghost still lingers. The FBI claims there have been changes. I didn't see any changes during the 5 years after he died, and I was still in. In fact, he was already dead when Geronimo Pratt was framed. Hoover died in April, and Geronimo Pratt was framed for a murder he didn't commit a month later.
You really reveal that story in depth in your book, so I guess the listeners who are interested will just have to get the book. We're coming to the close of our time, and I want to ask you one more question. Is what does a person do to change this level of corruption, that this incorrect way for our government to operate?
Well, it's really difficult to say when there's so much secrecy, but one of the ways is to, you know, pay attention to what's going on, and if you see something, report it to your congressman. If you're suspicious that, you know, the FBI is doing this or that, if the Department of Justice won't do anything and Congress won't do anything, you know, maybe go to the American Civil Liberties Union and talk to them. And there are times that you know, they will stand a person being victimized.
We have a very real aspect of that story in here in Mendocino County with Judy Berry, but that is another program for another time. Wesley Swearingen, I want to thank you very much for joining us here on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you the question I ask all of my guests at the end of an interview, and that is, could you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yeah. In fact, I have it right here, Official and Confidential, The Secret Life of J. Edgar Hoover by Anthony Summers. That's S-U-M-M-E-R-S. Very explosive book. It doesn't hold any punches. It goes much further into Hoover's individual personality and his sexual preferences than I do in my book.
Well, Wesley Swearingen, thank you very much for joining us here on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry, for having me.
In this archive edition of Radio Curious, recorded in December of 1995, our guest was Wesley Swearingen, a former FBI agent and the author of FBI Secrets, An Agent's Exposé. The book that Wesley Swearingen recommends is Official and Confidential, The Secret Life of J. Edgar Hoover by Anthony Summers. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.